Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The COVID-19 pandemic is a disaster. It may not feel like a tornado or a war or a terrorist attack, but it's a disaster that is affecting all of us, probably in ways we don't understand. Dr. George Everly is a disaster psychologist. Over four decades, he's worked in 39 countries on six continents, helping people and governments cope with disasters, with hurricanes, bombings, nuclear accidents, wars. As he says, he's usually going in when others are leaving. This is the third pandemic he's dealt with, and he says he's never seen anything quite like it. But much of what Dr. Everly has learned in all those other disasters is valuable right now. Dr. Everly is on the International Health Faculty of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and on the Psychiatry Faculty at the School of Medicine. And he writes a blog for Psychology Today called When Disaster Strikes. Dr. Everly joins us by Zoom. Welcome to On the Record.
Well, thank you very much, Sheila. It's a pleasure to be with you.
To pick just one of the dozens of disasters you've coped with, after the first Gulf War in the early 1990s, you went to Kuwait. What was it like when you got there?
It was breathtaking, literally and figuratively. It was a humanitarian disaster on a massive scale. It was also the largest ecological disaster since the Ice Age. If you remember, 700 oil wells were set ablaze, and there were over 3 million unexploded landmines, which set the stage for a remarkably hostile environment within which the human element, the people, ultimately had to not only recover, but to thrive. So what I was asked to do was to rebuild the mental health system, but it was a task I'd never faced quite in that manner before, because the mental health system had to be one based not on a medical model, but rather on a model of resilience. So to my knowledge, we built the world's first resiliency clinic. And ultimately, that was the foundation for the mental health system. So it was a rather remarkable experience.
It sounds very different from what we're living through now. What lessons are relevant to us?
It was the only disaster that I had ever been to or had ever heard about, where the material resources actually exceeded what the need was. In other words, most of the time we go to a disaster site, material resources are scarce. And we sometimes believe that recovery is predicated upon provision of material provisions alone. What I learned in Kuwait was here was a country that was quite wealthy in material resources, rebuilt the physical infrastructure in amazingly rapid time. But what it also underscored for me was that simply rebuilding the physical infrastructure was inadequate for a country, for a community to recover. The human element, the people, had to recover. And that was my role.
So how do we do that?
I think we understand that physical needs must be met. It is hard to foster motivation and energy and forward thinking without certain basic physical needs being met. But once those are met, we should not be complacent. We should now funnel our resources to building the psychological infrastructure. We want people to thrive, not just be resilient, although that is the first step, but we want them to thrive. So what must we do to ignite the flame of energy and motivation in people, especially when they've just been knocked down by some great adversity? The answer, specific answer to that question may vary from community to community, from nation to nation, but that should nevertheless not keep us from digging down and finding out what those answers are. What do people need psychologically?
What are the predictable phases of a disaster? And where are we in this one?
So when you take a look at hurricanes or tornadoes or nuclear incidents or pandemics, they seem so different, and they are as agents. But what our research has pointed to very, very clearly is that there is a predictable trajectory of psychological recovery, if you will, of the psychological aftermath, regardless of the agent. While the time frames certainly differ, one thing that we do know is that the psychological trajectory is predictable. So why is this important? Well, for the first answer, it would be it's important epidemiologically. It allows us to predict when people will be having their greatest psychological distress and their greatest psychological energy to recover. It allows us logistically to better plan for the application of what is often scarce resources so that we maximize the return on investment, if you will, in terms of allocation of those resources. We can put the right resources at the wrong time and have them fail miserably. So the trajectory is a powerful public health planning tool. Now to your point, where are we? So the phases typically start with the pre-impact and then the impact of something. After that, we see a fairly predictable phase called the heroic phase. This is where rescue and recovery personnel do remarkable things. This is where people in the community reach out and help one another. They do remarkable things. But it's riding a bit of an adrenaline rush. So ideally, we do these heroic things. We foster the beginnings of recovery. We enter a honeymoon phase. We stop and we look around and we say, wow, I'm really glad we dodged that. I'm sad for what we've lost, but by golly, we made it through, and this is good. But like most honeymoons, they don't last forever. At the end of the honeymoon phase, once we've looked around, we've taken stock, and we've seen what we've lost and what we've retained, and we look around and we say, you know, I'm glad we survived. I'm glad we have what we have, but why did this have to happen? Why did it have to happen to me? It seems so unfair. And then we enter a disillusionment phase. This is the anger. This is the finger pointing. People begin to grieve, and they ultimately descend into an abyss of despair. So the job of the disaster psychologist, the disaster psychiatrist, is to hopefully shorten the duration and the depth of this disillusionment phase to begin, and to foster the beginning of resilience, of the recovery, of the rebuilding, and perhaps even coming out of this stronger than before. And that's what I've been doing for 40 years.
That's disaster psychologist Dr. George Everly here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. He's on the faculty at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's written or co-written more than 20 books, including the Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid. We're talking about the psychological toll of COVID-19. You have said that this pandemic is the most psychologically toxic you've seen. How do you measure that?
Ultimately, we will look back and the epidemiologists will tell us whether it was or it was not. I can simply tell you from my perspective on the ground that this one is remarkably toxic. But we have been able to develop a bit of a predictive formula so that we can predict not the absolute number, but the relative number of what I'll call psychological casualties. Now, psychological casualty would be someone who can't do what they need to do. I mean, that's the bottom line. Whether it's personal hygiene, going to work and earning a living, whether it's elder care, whether it's child care, they can't do those essential things. So that person for lack of a better term, we will call a psychological casualty. Now, what disaster research has taught us for decades is that psychological casualties will always outnumber physical casualties, and they collectively, the physical casualties combined with the psychological casualties, constitute the ultimate burden on humanity that any disaster may exert. The estimations have been based on past disasters, would be that the psychological casualties outnumber physical casualties by a number of 4 to 1, up to maybe 50 or 100 to 1. This particular pandemic, I think, will be closer to the 50 to 100 to 1 psychological to physical casualty ratio.
You're saying 50 times as many people will have some kind of psychological problem because of this pandemic, 50 times as many as are actually infected with COVID-19?
No question. Absolutely. And it's compounded by the ripple effect economically. That is based on history. So for example, the sarin gas attacks in the 1990s, where sarin gas was released in the subway system in Tokyo, a very, very few number of people were actually infected, less than 1,000. But close to 5,000 people showed up at emergency rooms. And the physicians at the emergency rooms, the ones that they could see the actual patients, said most of this was psychological injury. They had no exposure to the sarin gas whatsoever. In this particular pandemic, as I mentioned, the economic ripple effect is just going to be even more of a multiplier. And we see that. What is the unemployment rate as a direct result of the pandemic? They would be, in my opinion, examples of psychological casualties.
We need to take a quick break in our conversation with Dr. George Everly. On the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health faculty, who's offered psychological support in scores of disasters around the world. And when we're back, how can we start moving on past the pandemic? I'm Sheila Kass. Stay with us on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking this morning about the psychological impact of the coronavirus pandemic with someone who has helped people recover from scores of disasters in dozens of countries around the world, Dr. George Everly of the Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. If you're predicting that 50 times as many of us will be hurt psychologically by this pandemic as will literally be infected by the virus, what steps should our government be taking right now about that?
One of the things that we think leaders need to do is to communicate openly, honestly, and frequently. One of the barriers I've encountered, not in this pandemic, but in the past, is that leaders sometimes hesitate to communicate because they say to themselves, we don't want to say anything that is incorrect. And that is laudable. But in the age of social media, the game has changed. There is no such thing as an information vacuum. If leaders aren't communicating, someone else is. And it's often the people that are at the greatest level of distress and confusion. And they're reaching out looking for guidance. So the first thing we recommend from a leadership standpoint is, again, communicate frequently, openly, and honestly. What we have found time and time again is if you are communicating openly and honestly, you are building trust. So that if you make a mistake, And you have to come back and say, by the way, I was wrong. People are remarkably forgiving. So communication is important. Being decisive. People not only want you to communicate as a leader, they want you to do something. So when you communicate and you say, here's the problem, the next logical question that someone will ask is, and what are you doing about it? Sometimes the mistake that leaders make that we've seen in the past is they wait for that moment of absolute certainty. How many times, Sheila, in your personal life, perhaps, I know in mine, I've waited, tried to wait for that moment of absolute certainty before making a decision. And sometimes I've waited and waited and waited, and the opportunity actually goes away. I've lost the opportunity. We can't allow that to happen. Leaders must be decisive. So communication, decisiveness, having a vision. We have been doing leadership, crisis leadership research for over a decade. And the single most powerful predictor of effective crisis leadership is having an optimistic, forward-thinking vision. People often look to leaders to give them some sort of reassurance or psychological strength, a reason to look forward. The assumption is the leaders know something that we don't. And without necessarily telling us what those things that you know and we don't, but it's important to be realistically, and that's underscore realistically, optimistic. And lastly, I think one of the factors that emerged from our research that I think is important as well is the notion of some sort of compassionate moral compass, a sense of integrity. So those are the four things that we think really should guide leaders as they try to guide the rest of us through things like this pandemic.
At this stage, would you offer a grade on how our leaders are meeting those standards?
Absolutely not. Not in my field.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with disaster psychologist Dr. George Everly. We're talking about the psychological impact of the coronavirus pandemic and what we can do about it. A couple of weeks ago, I was interviewing someone on a completely different topic. He seemed energetic and passionate about his work. And then I asked how the pandemic is affecting the way he thought about his work, and his answer floored me. He said essentially, I'm working at home. I haven't touched anyone for weeks. My dominant feeling is that I am lonely. How do people cope with that?
That's distressing, isn't it? One of the things that we know about this from the studies of human resilience is that the single best predictor of human resilience is being connected to other people. So we started almost right out of the box using a term that, in my humble opinion, was a mistake. We called it social distancing. It's not. It's physical distancing. In fact, social distancing is, in my opinion, a tremendous mistake. So I can understand on a professional level what your guest was saying. I can understand on a personal level. I am resigned to my COVID bunker at my home. I go out certainly less frequently than I would like. I interact with people less frequently than I like. But what I've done is to make a conscious effort to reach out to people through the electronic media. So I'm texting people far more frequently. I'm calling and talking to people. I've discovered this thing called Zoom, where you can actually see people. And my goal, my imperative, which I would suggest would be something that we should all strive for, is to not socially distance. Yes, physically distance, because the data suggests it keeps people healthy and alive. But no, we must socially connect.
One of your many lectures on YouTube for CSIM, the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, which you co-founded, you note that most of us will move on from the pandemic, move on with our lives or build new lives. And you walk through some of the steps you say can help us get started moving on. Tell us about some of those.
Oh, there's so many different ways to get started depending on where you are. I think that, again, beginning to reach out to others is an important first step, understanding the importance of social interaction, interpersonal support. I think taking care of yourself is important. And it's not selfish. In fact, I'm sure you've flown a great deal. The flight attendant always says when the mask falls, in case unlikely occurrence that the mask falls down, put your mask on first. One of the mistakes that we make is that we give and we give and we give, and we don't take care of ourselves, and we fail to remember that the best way to take care of others, whether it's our significant others, our children, our coworkers, whomever, the best way to take care of others is to take care of ourselves.
What do you mean by taking care of yourself?
I think I approach it from a wellness or a holistic being kind of perspective. We are physical beings and we are psychological beings. So in that context, physically, what can we do to take care of ourselves? Working at home is perhaps a mixed one. It isolates us, but it also gives us the opportunity perhaps to take more frequent breaks than we would have before. Taking a break, walking outside, walking down the street, maybe getting in your car and just taking a drive just to get out of the neighborhood. Maybe that would be helpful. Can we do some form of exercise? I've discovered, for golly's sake, the push-up, and it's amazing. It even though it doesn't sound like much, it makes me feel like I'm doing something for myself physically. I've actually cut back on my sweets because I love chocolate. I've cut back on those things. I have started to take back control of my life, and part of taking back control of our lives, Sheila, I think, is understanding what we can control and what we can't. And the only thing that we really, really can control is how we react to things. And that has been my message over and over and over again. People seem to put their happiness, their psychological well-being, and hang it on a contingency of a vaccine or a treatment. And those things are certainly important, don't get me wrong. But control what we can, and the thing that we can control the most is how we react to the world as it unfolds around us. I believe it was John Milton in the first book of Paradise Lost. He said, the mind is its own self, and that itself can make a heaven of a hell or a hell of a heaven. We do not have to be helpless psychologically in the wake of this pandemic.
Dr. Everly, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. George Everly is a disaster psychologist for 4 decades in 39 countries on 6 continents, helping people move on after disasters. He's written more than 20 books, including The Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid, and with Dr. Douglas Strauss and Dennis McCormick, Stronger, Develop the Resilience You Need to Succeed. We've got links at the On the Record page, wypr.org. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. Special thanks to WIPR's digital producer, Jamila Kremple, for posting our audio to the website this week. I'm your host, Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us on the Record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.